Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, and welcome to the subscriber version of Inside Total Film, and thank you so much, as always, for subscribing. Today, I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
Hello, and our deputy editor, Matt Mason.
Hello.
This week, we're assessing One Night in Miami, and we're talking to one of its stars, Kingsley Ben-Adir. We're also reviewing Stardust, Blythe Spirit, Archive, and MLK FBI. So shall we kick off? First of all, we've got quite a lot to get through. With this.
Ah, yeah, that's the show.
Don't you think it's about time to party?
Tonight is a chance for us to reflect.
Hey. You mean no one else is coming?
Well, this is off to a hopping start.
You all are a bright and shining future.
You need to understand what is at stake here.
Everything's not so black and white like you make it out to be.
But we are fighting for our lives.
You know I know what's going on out there, right?
Listen, listen. Brothers and sisters, listen, listen.
So that's One Night in Miami, Kemp Powers' play adapted for the screen, which explores what might have happened on an evening in 1964 when Cassius Clay, Malcolm X, Sam Cooke and Jim Brown met up in a Florida hotel room. Before we talk about the film, let's hear what Kingsley Ben-Adir, who plays Malcolm X, had to say when Matt sat down with him earlier this week.
Yeah, it was a great chat. And he's obviously a really smart guy. And we talked about obviously working with Regina King and the fact he nearly played Muhammad Ali in a previous film. But I started off by asking him to set up the film for anyone who hasn't seen it or the Kemp Powers play that it's based on.
The film has been adapted from the play One Night in Miami, which is about a particular night, 25th of Feb, 1964, when then Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, became heavyweight champion of the world for the first time. And that evening, he went to Malcolm X's hotel room with Jim Brown and Sam Cooke. And this is Kemp Powers' reimagining of the conversations that may have gone down on that night.
And you nearly played Muhammad Ali on a previous project years ago, didn't you? So is that the role that you were kind of first offered here, or was it always Malcolm X you were going to be playing when this project came to you?
Well, I definitely wasn't offered anything. but the audition, the opportunity to audition for Regina came about in the summer. The screenplay was sent to me to read for Cassius Clay because a few years before I was signed up to play Muhammad Ali in a different movie. That never happened in the end. I read One Night in Miami and I loved it. I felt too old to play Cass. I didn't connect with Cass in this story. For me, like personally as an actor, I don't know if I felt a little bit too old or I was just sort of done with the idea of playing that part because I was testing and training to play Muhammad Ali for nearly 2 years. So it went on and on and on and on. And this was a completely different Muhammad Ali and he, you know, 22-year-old and the Ali who I was set to play was in his 30s. It was the Thriller in Manila. So anyway, I spoke to my agent and just said, this isn't for me, but if anything happens to the actor who's playing Malcolm X or if that part becomes available, as sometimes it does, give me a shout. It would be my honor to audition for that part or to, you know, share some work with Regina. Yeah, cut to sort of a couple of weeks before Christmas and something happened and Regina was, she was under real pressure to find her Malcolm X. She literally had a couple of weeks to find him. So I was like, I'm in, this is my opportunity to audition for this part. And yeah, and I put something on tape and then Regina and I started a conversation that went on for, you know, a week or so. And then, yeah, she cast me just before Christmas.
So did you know a lot about Malcolm X before this opportunity kind of came up?
I did, yeah. I mean, I had the autobiography of Malcolm X for a number of years. I've read it a couple of times, you know, aware of who Malcolm was and what he meant to so many people and to me.
And did you learn anything kind of about him that changed any of the kind of preconceptions you might have had through making
this? Oh, my God. Oh, so much. I was studying him, listening to him, watching him, reading about him, trying to tap into whatever essence I could for like 2.5 months. It was a deep dive and there was lots and lots and lots of digging. I guess the most important information for me was really coming to understand Malcolm's relationship with Dick Gregory and that friendship that he had. And there were so many wonderful gems that Dick Gregory shares about Malcolm, the private Malcolm, the Malcolm who sort of outside the media, the father, the husband. Dick described him as a sweet and bashful man, good humored And the lacerating demagogue that we all know was really a character that he slipped in and out of, but it really wasn't the sum total of who Malcolm was. And the way he leveraged the media was genius. But there's a different side to Malcolm, and I think a side to him that we aren't as familiar with. And that was most appealing about this project. When I first read it, I was like, oh, wow, this is Malcolm in a way that we haven't seen him before. There's something about Kemp's words and the story that made me feel like the vulnerability of this piece and the friendship between these guys and the emotional sort of subtext or undercurrent of this piece is everything. Like, the story arc is going to rely on this in a massive way. In fact, without it doesn't work. And I thought, this is really different. And this is really an opportunity to, like, all of the characters. But Malcolm, for me, it was an opportunity to explore him in a different way. And I read that Malcolm said to Dick that around this time, he felt weak and he felt hollow, and that no one knew the torments that he went through. As, you know, there was such a strong feeling that he was being pushed out of the Nation of Islam, and his relationship with Elijah Muhammad was really crumbling and coming to an end, and monumental shifts in his political thinking and his religious thinking. It was a deep dive in. I learned so much about him that I didn't know before.
And obviously, as you mentioned, One Night in Miami is directed by Regina King, who we know is a great actor, seen recently in things like Watchmen and If Beale Street Could Talk. Like, what does she bring to the table as a director?
Regina understands the acting process better than anyone that I've ever worked with. I assume that before putting a foot on set. She's a particular kind of brilliant actor. She's always operating from a deep sense of truth and empathy and, like, realness. And I imagined that would, you know, be the case when she was dealing with us. And it really was. Like, she created a safe space. She created a set where we were allowed to just come in and play and figure it out together all the way through. There's a million things going on, you know, on sets, and they can be really distracting, and filming can often be quite like a technical process. But Regina really made it feel like a rehearsal room floor for so much of it. And that was very unique. And my first experience of having that kind of atmosphere on set, where I was allowed to stay in character and we were allowed to try things out. We felt safe to make mistakes because Regina's taste and instinct is so on point. You trust her fully, and what she's going to use is going to be, you know, the best stuff. So you don't mind putting some mistakes in the can for her. And so much of, like, discovery as an actor and figuring it out is in the play of it, you know. And like, until you get in and you're listening and responding to the actors who are in front of you and see what they're giving you, and that you can really find the magical stuff in acting. And without a director who's willing to let you do that, it can be tricky. But not with this. It was just a joy to come in every day and try and, you know, figure out what each scene was.
Was it easy? Because obviously, in many ways, this film rests on those four iconic characters and you four actors playing them. So did you guys slip into that chemistry very easily?
We had to. You know what I mean? You've got no choice. It's interesting, this thing about chemistry and, like, rapport and, like, getting on with each other. And, you know, I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that, like, good friendship and fun times always creates the best work. Like, it's not, I don't think it's as simple as that. We had so much to do and so much to work out and no time to rehearse that we really came in and had to get on with it. And over those 12 days over Christmas that I had to prepare, I knew it was going to be really important for me to come in on the first day and know that piece like it was a play. I wanted to come in able to play any part of that movie at any moment that Regina needed. And I said to Regina, like, before we started, I said to her, every day I'm coming in hard and heavy, and I'm going to go big, and we're going to work our way back. I don't want to waste any time in trying to ease in to the role, or, like, ease into the day, or ease into coverage. It was like, I'm going to come flying in hard and heavy, and then we'll work it out from there so we could figure out what worked and what didn't. And there were some moments in the first week where that was a little bit tricky. It took us a few days to really find our groove together. But when we did, you know, we were off. And it was a joyous, joyous process, man. It was a process like no other for me. I've never had anything like that. I've never had a character like Malcolm, a director like Regina, and an opportunity to, like, explore transformational acting and, like, stay in character and come in and, like, and do all that. Independent films and, character acting was like the stuff that really, really excited me when I was like 17 or 18. And I guess it's always been sort of desperately hoping that somehow I'd get to be a part of that, you know, and going to drama school was a way in, and you do bits and bobs on the TV and you're just trying to like survive in this industry and just keep going. It's just to get a job. So to get to play Malcolm with Regina, and to get to play Malcolm with Regina in a way where like she allowed us to explore and play in that way, just a dream come true. Like I can't believe it happened. But yeah, it was a joyous process. And in terms of chemistry and like friendship and bonding between all of us guys, we got there after a few days, but it took us a minute to like figure out how we were all approaching it. Coming in as hard and heavy as I did, it took the boys a minute to adjust and figure it out, but we got there in the end.
So that was Kingsley Benadire talking about One Night in Miami. What did we think of this film? It's got some awards buzz. Did you like it?
I really liked it, yeah. Obviously, you can tell to an extent that it's based on a play, and there's just the structure of it and the fact it is mostly based in one hotel room and it's so sort of performance-led. But I didn't mind that at all. And I actually, there's times where it opens out a bit and you know, you go outside the room kind of before and after and you see some other bits. But I thought it was at its strongest when you did have these four guys together in the room, kind of bouncing off each other. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. What about you guys?
I didn't like it for that reason. I found it weirdly fake because it was quite stagey because of its origins. So I sort of couldn't get that out of my head. So it never felt properly real to me. Did you like it, Jordan?
Yeah, I'm more on Matt's side in this debate. I really enjoyed it as kind of a performance-driven kind of piece. I thought all four of the main actors were just exceptional, especially Eli Gorey as Cassius Clay, the future Muhammad Ali. I thought he just nailed Cassius Clay so well. I'd never seen him in anything before, and I was completely sideswiped by just how good he was. But I just found this like really deep and impactful and really soulful. I thought it had a ton of things to say. I wasn't acutely aware of the careers of most of these people. Sam Cooke, for example, is someone who's, you know, music I've heard, but I wasn't aware of who he was as a person and what he stood for and all these kind of things. So I did find it quite illuminating and educational in that way as well. And it's just quite entertaining. I found it really fun the way that the men just bounce off each other and, you know, constantly come to loggerheads. It was just both full of dramatic potential and just really enjoyable. I really, really liked it. And as a directorial debut from Regina King, I thought it was really impressive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, really, really good. She isn't in it at all. This is purely her, you know, authorial voice as a director. You know, it's quite clear that she's got a very strong second career other than being one of the best actresses on the planet. She's also a very, very competent director as well.
Again, I largely agree, especially on the performances, because this is quite a hard thing because these are sort of four icons in their own ways. I thought they were all really good at it. I agree that Eli Gorey was great as Muhammad Ali, but Kingsley Benadire as Malcolm X, I thought was great. Like I previously just seen him in like Noel with Anna Kendrick and also Love Life with Anna Kendrick, in which he's kind of like charming and likable, but I thought he really kind of transformed for this because obviously he's British, and I just thought it was a really great performance. And he kind of perhaps has the biggest arc maybe out of everyone, out of the four people. And Leslie Odom Jr., who perhaps again we best know from Hamilton, he's obviously brings the voice as well to Sam Cooke, and he gets possibly the most emotional moment in the film, I'd say as well. They all have these great moments, and then also you get like the guys when they're interacting with each other kind of separately, there's sort of opportunities for them to break off and split into different sort of pairings and different groups, and they bring out different things in each other. So I thought that was a really nice aspect of the film as well. I'd highly recommend it.
I would almost say, because the film starts with these sort of four vignettes, which sets up each of the men outside this hotel room in Miami. And I completely agree with you, Matt, that it's by far at its strongest when it's actually in the hotel room. I'm not entirely sure I even really needed those vignettes at the beginning. I would have rather it just got straight into it and put these men together straight away.
I liked that. I really liked that. If you didn't have that, it would be even more stagey, because obviously the stage version just is in that hotel room and you don't get that outside life. And I think it's really important to see Cassius Clay in the ring and to see what Malcolm X is doing before he turns up at the hotel room, and to see the humiliation that Sam Cooke goes through, you know, doing a show at a sort of supper club where nobody cares and doesn't really like what he's doing. I think those are really important because they bring all that to the room with them.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. The other thing that I was slightly unsure about, because obviously this is sort of an imagined scenario, it sort of led me to question what was real and what wasn't. Because obviously, you know, Cassius Clay won the World Heavyweight Championship against Sonny Liston on this night in Miami. But did the things that happened before happen? Because as I said, I don't have an intimate knowledge of the history of several of these men.
But then I suppose that's the mark of a good film if it makes you want to go off and research this stuff and find out more about something you didn't know about.
Exactly, yeah. And afterwards, I did read at least the Wikipedia biographies of all these guys.
I mean, obviously, we know that they did actually meet that night. They were all in the city at the same time, and you know, Malcolm X was ringside when Cassius Clay was doing his fight, and they did meet at some point in the evening, but we don't know what happened or what they discussed. So the imagined part of it obviously is what happened in that room.
You can sort of imagine them all partying that night, but I guess the idea of the film is that they all gather in this hotel room to reflect, as Malcolm X puts it, which basically means to get into it, to get into what they can do to further the civil rights movement, Malcolm X believes they're falling short on, all that kind of stuff. So rather than drinking the night away, it is a very sort of philosophical, talky, powerful type of human drama as well.
And very pertinent, even though it's, you know, a 60s set film, the issues are very relevant to today.
100%, yeah.
Okay, so we're highly recommending One Night in Miami, which hits Amazon tomorrow, Friday. Okay, so let's leave the 60s, shall we? Should we go on a decade? And let's hit up the 70s with this.
Hello.
Name?
David Bowie.
12 singles, everyone a total failure, except Space Oddity. The record company finds the album too weird for the Yanks.
I need to be known. I need them to know me.
There's only one guy at Mercury who doesn't hate your new record with every bone in his body.
David Bowie, I presume. Ron Oberman, Mercury Records.
We got a packed couple weeks coming up. Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, and then out to L.A.
I think we can make it work. All it takes is one believer to change the world. And we got two.
Two?
You believe in yourself, don't you?
So that's Stardust, a David Bowie biopic, but not Jordan.
Yeah, exactly. Rather than a sort of cradle to the grave biopic, this story focuses particularly on Bowie's first US tour in 1971. I use the term tour quite loosely there because if you're picturing sort of sold out gigs and screaming fans, that wasn't what happened. Because despite the fact this was a couple of years after he'd released Space Oddity, Bowie's third album, The Man Who Sold the World, was sort of considered too challenging for the general public, and his label, Mercury Records, had zero belief in the record. So they send Bowie to America for this so-called nationwide tour, but they fail to pay a work visa for him. So he's unable to sing or perform while he's out there officially.
Which is convenient for this film, isn't it?
Exactly.
Bearing in mind, one of the major things about this film is that the Bowie estate and Bowie's son and family did not let them use any Bowie music in the film. So it's a film about Bowie and his music without any of the songs that we know from that era.
Yeah, jumping ahead slightly, that is the sort of big issue with the film, right? Because if you're going to watch a film about David Bowie, you just need to hear his music, because his music is just completely inseparable from him as a man. It sort of makes you wonder why they even bothered at all if they knew from the start that they wouldn't be able to use any of his music. You know, there have been music biopics that have done this before.
Velvet Goldmine.
Velvet Goldmine, exactly, who Bowie famously wouldn't let Todd Haynes use any of his music in the film. But for example, England Is Mine from a few years back, which is a Morrissey biopic that starred Jack Loudon, that didn't feature any of his music, but was set before Morrissey had written any of the songs he would become known for. So it still made sense that there wasn't any of his music in it. But Stardust, this film, is set in 1971. As I said, 2 years after he's written Space Oddity. It's sort of about the creation of Ziggy Stardust. It just seems insane that you wouldn't have any of his music in it. And they do this thing as well where they sort of have Bowie-like music on the soundtrack.
Yes, and at some point, that.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of feels a bit Bowie, but isn't officially, and they can't get sued for it.
And he does sing some songs that he did actually cover when he was on that tour, some other people's songs. So he does sing songs that we do know that Bowie sang, so that are period appropriate. but we
this
don't
is how
get
they get around
else.
It yeah. Yeah, but then you do have a moment where he's actually performing as Ziggy Stardust and you're like, oh, you're just waiting for him to sing Life on Mars, and then he just sings something you haven't heard of, and it's kind of meant to be this rousing moment, and you're like, oh, this just isn't working. The fact that his music isn't in it is really the nail in the coffin. But there were things that I did like about this film. In the same way as One Night in Miami was sort of educational for me, I didn't know this story. I didn't know this chapter of Bowie's life. I didn't know about this disastrous US tour in 1971. And it is, there's this dynamic between Bowie and his publicist from Mercury Records, Ron Oberman, paid by Marc Maron. He's kind of driving him around America in this beaten up station wagon from, you know, vacuum cleaner salesman conferences yeah. where he performs on acoustic guitars to
wearing a dress.
Meetings with Andy Warhol, wearing a dress. Yeah. And I kind of enjoyed the dynamic between them because Ron is this kind of grizzled patron saint of lost causes who's like the one person left at Mercury who still believes in Bowie. The Man Who Sold the World, the album he's there to promote, is an album about mental illness and schizophrenia and these very dark things that were part of Bowie's life at the time because his brother suffered from schizophrenia. As far as Bowie is concerned, well, the film posits, everything he wants to say on that subject is contained within the album. He doesn't want to be going to journalists and talking about these issues. So instead of actually, you know, going deep and giving journalists what they might want, instead, he says that it's about drugs, or he starts doing his mime act. So everything he's there to do just goes horribly wrong.
Self-sabotaging himself in a way.
Exactly, yeah. So I did quite enjoy that aspect of it. What did you guys think?
I wasn't a big fan. Like, there were certain things I didn't mind about it. And especially, to be completely honest, I went in with low expectations, knowing about, you know, the fact they couldn't get any of Bowie's music and things like that. So I went in with kind of tempered expectations. And yeah, there were aspects of it that I liked, but it was one of those films that maybe I was just projecting my own feelings on it, but I almost felt like most people involved just seemed faintly embarrassed to be doing it almost. And Johnny Flynn, who's obviously a talented actor, I felt his performance was very uneven. And there were moments where I sort of really warmed to him, but then there were times where it almost came across as a bit sort of parodic almost, and just a bit embarrassing, you know, I felt like, just because, again, we all just know Bowie so well, you know, and what he looks like, what he sounds like. And when he eventually gets the red hair, I actually laughed, you know, when that moment came up, because it just looked so silly to me. It just was so sort of wiggy and so just someone playing dress up.
I found the teeth very distracting.
Yeah. They were correct. They are, as well. Those were good Bowie teeth, though. They were correct for Bowie in the period. But
they look strange on Johnny Flynn's face. Like, they just didn't look right. And I didn't believe the voice was Bowie's either. Like, a lot of things in the performance just didn't add up for me.
Yeah, and sometimes he'd be like, hello, I'm David Bowie, and the rest of the time it was like, all right, I'm David Bowie. It was just like, and probably that's exactly how David Bowie did talk. He probably rolled out the Bowie when he wanted to. But yeah, as you say, I found it kind of like they hadn't gone full hog onto it. You know, I'm a Bowie fan, and I just found certain things a bit bewildering, like the fact that people kept mentioning the album title just in case you weren't aware. Like, they said it at least three times. The fact that people say, I hate it in things that are in the past with the benefit of hindsight, when people say things like, one day people will get you, but right now they don't. And it's things like, no one would have ever probably said that in 1971. And the fact as well, like, they just completely skip over Hunky Dory. So they ignore an entire album to get straight to the Ziggy Stardust period. That sort of thing just feels a bit careless. I thought, if I'm going to go for a David Bowie biopic that doesn't have music, I'm going to go for the much more fun Velvet Goldmine, because at least it's as wild. Cool, sure. and you know how I love it. It has much more swagger, much more strut to it, and than this does.
It captures his elusiveness more as well, even though it's obviously Brian Slade rather than David Bowie. It just captures that elusiveness of his kind of persona much more. And this one I also found as well, like, this taught me some things I wasn't aware about Bowie and his brother, and, you know, this kind of disastrous tour. But it really felt like it oversimplified a lot of things, like, and to use the Orson Welles phrase of, like, Dollarbook Freud, just some things were just so kind of heavy-handedly done. Particularly, there's a bit where he visits his brother at an institution and his brother's undergoing drama therapy, where it's like, oh, if you're not happy, pretend being someone else.
Why don't you pretend to be a pop star? Yeah.
But I wasn't sure if that was real or not.
Bowie did visit his brother in the hospital and sent him postcards during his tours around the world, apparently. So was involved and had visited him there. Whether or not he decided, oh, I'll play Ziggy Stardust. Stardust as a character. Who knows? But yeah, it is quite simplistic. And you can sort of understand why members of the Bowie family are not particularly thrilled about that sort of avenue that they've gone down. I watched this with a real Bowie fan who sort of felt like it was quite a cynical cash-in, releasing 5 years after he's died. And, you know, the first single on Ziggy Stardust is called 5 Years. But that's probably a bit inside baseball for Bowie fans. But yeah, it felt a little bit like, we want to do it, we're going to do it, and that's it. And whether or not the product is actually great at the end of it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think there's probably a good reason why the Bowie estate, the Jones estate, refused to be involved with this film. It's not great, and I'm sure there'll be a better one at some point in the future, yeah. But sadly, this isn't the great Bowie biopic.
No, we're still waiting for that. So if you're into Bowie and you're interested to see it, go ahead, but we're not going to say it's essential. Stardust is available on all platforms from tomorrow. Okay, so let's leave the 60s and the 70s and go back in time to this.
The ghost of my first wife is here with us in the room. Surely you can see her. She's standing right next to you.
Are you drunk? Who's she?
My wife.
I'm your wife.
Not anymore.
Can he by any chance touch her? I sincerely hope not. It's not a coincidence that you haven't published a word since my demise.
Finished the first act of my screenplay. Elvira helped me.
She's dangerous, Charles.
You're the one I love.
I haven't the foggiest idea how to send her back.
You're in trouble now.
So this is Blythe Spirit, which is the famous Noel Coward play. Matt, what's it about?
So it's directed by Edward Hall, who's the son of notable theatre director Sir Pete Hall and his brother of Rebecca Hall. And it revolves around a writer, Charles Condamine, played by Dan Stevens. And he's having a moment of writer's block. And to try and get out of this, he arranges a seance with Judy Dench's Madame Arcati, thinking it's all just going to be a bit of fun and he's going to use it, you know, as some sort of source material. But then what actually happens is it brings back his first wife from the dead, Elvira, played by Leslie Mann, and she kind of haunts him. He's currently married to Isla Fisher's Ruth, but having Elvira back in his life does sort of get his mojo back a bit and gets his creative juices flowing again. And it sort of goes on from there, really.
And many japes ensue.
I wasn't the biggest fan of this film. Like, I was kind of on board for the first act maybe or so, and genuinely think Dan Stevens and Isla Fisher both have very good kind of comedy chops and really feel well suited to this sort of period that they're playing. But I really, really, really struggled to sort of stay interested in it. Mainly, I think, because I really struggled to sort of warm to any of the characters. There's just no one I was really sort of rooting for. I sort of enjoyed the setup, but then once Elvira was back on the scene, I just, yeah, found it all very laboured and just not particularly funny. And yeah, I struggled with it. What did you guys find?
Yeah, I mostly agree. I was enjoying it for a good 40 minutes or so. As it goes on, it just feels like you can see exactly where it's going, and they still like managed to tighten the screw, and you had all have all these absurd sort of situations, all these garden parties that result in zany antics. But for me, it just wasn't funny enough. It's kind of one of those gently amusing films that you'll probably enjoy over a cup of tea on a Sunday afternoon, but it's not the kind of film that would, you know, play well in a raucous Friday night screening if cinemas were still open. You're not going to be like chuckling to yourself in your seat. It's fine. It's perfectly entertaining. I think it's probably quite well suited to home viewing on Sky Cinema, which is where it's releasing. I think if this was a cinema release, it would be even more disappointing. And I would say as a remake of the original, it didn't really improve or do anything different enough to really warrant its existence for me.
I've seen this on stage a couple of times as well as the original film. And the point of Noel Coward is he's frothy and light and quick and sparky. And if you see it done well, then you do feel sort of bobbed along on this froth of silliness, and you sort of accept what's going on, you know, as part of the thing, and you go with it. But it just felt like this wasn't frothy or bobby or light. It just felt really weirdly leaden, and that froth wasn't in that. And I'd go so far as to say that in the performances, you've got Leslie Mann, who can make anything sound funny, and she just wasn't on full Leslie Mann. And, you know, everyone was really trying very hard. And I don't know, I can't really decide whether it's the direction or the adapted screenplay that's doing that and bringing that down. But it wasn't the froth that I was looking for. I did like the fact that they'd sort of tried to modernize it by sort of taking this angle more of a, you know, women's work being credited to men and men taking the credit for the work that women do. And they even have this sort of nod to Thelma and Louise at the end. But it didn't feel like it did that enough to swing it to that. So it's like, this is a fresh take. But yet at the same time, it wasn't as traditional enough to actually maintain that froth and lightness of touch. So it sort of fell between two stools for me. And yeah, I agree with you. I think it'll do well on Sky Cinema. And it's certainly the sort of film that I think parents will enjoy. And, you know, if you're looking for a Sunday afternoon thing that doesn't, you know, take a lot of brain power and you want to see Isla Fisher stripping off and marching through a fish pond in a drunken way, which is very amusing, this is the thing for you.
The best thing about it for me were Leslie Mann's amazing outfits. Oh, she looks quite fabulous.
She got all the best outfits and pretty much all the best lines.
That's the best thing I can say about it, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to see Leslie Mann wearing fabulous pillbox hats and marvellous, like, 20s trousers and just wonderful gloves, it's a great time, right?
5 stars for the outfits alone.
Yeah. Okay, so production design and costumes, amazing. Maybe not the film. Okay, so that is on Sky Cinema from this Friday, the 15th. Okay, so from classic comedy to dystopian sci-fi now, it's this.
I'm working on something.
To bring you back.
They've never managed to connect a computer to the archive before. I waited a long time, and then I saw something.
So this is Archive. Jordan, is it about dusty old libraries?
Sort of. The futuristic equivalent of them, I guess. So yeah, this is from Gavin Rothery, who was the conceptual designer and visual effects supervisor on Moon. It's his feature debut as writer and director. It's set in the near future, 2038. Theo James stars as George Ulmore. He's a scientist living in this incredible home/science laboratory in the Japanese mountains where he's working on a true human equivalent AI. He's already built these two prototypes, J1 and J2, these boxy gonk droid-like machines, only the latter of which can sort of speak and apparently feel emotion. But it's J3, his latest creation, which he's made his greatest breakthrough because it's housed in this robotic human shell that, you know, skin aside, is basically indistinguishable from a human. And then at the same time, you have this technology called an archive, which is a backup of a deceased human consciousness. George seemingly is housing his wife in one, who died in a road accident. And at this point, you can probably guess where all this is going. But this is very much from the sort of ruminative, introspective, philosophical kind of sci-fi mold. It's not an action-packed kind of thing. There's a lot of musing going on in this film. And even though I imagine it didn't have the biggest budget in the world, one of the things I like the most about this film is it looks like it was made for an awful lot of money. Yeah. There's some really gorgeous kind of set design and these incredible establishing shots of snow-capped forests and these incredible waterfalls. And there's definitely a sense of a bigger story going on around the story of George and his robots, that there's this kind of corporate warfare going off camera. That's little more than tantalizing hints that didn't necessarily feel like it was a choice and something he had to do because there wasn't enough of a budget to expand beyond the walls of this laboratory. The thing I like the most about the film were these robots that he creates, J2 especially, almost becomes jealous of J3 as J3 starts to become George's priority. And actually J2, I actually cared about her quite a lot. There's a lot of sort of pathos to her character arc, if you can call it that, over the course of the film. She sort of starts to sabotage his experiments and is basically doing everything she can to not just ensure her own survival, but to kind of ensure that her relationship with George continues. So I found that aspect really interesting. But without spoiling anything, I would say that the sort of last 20 minutes did not leave me satisfied in the slightest. It kind of does the pull the rug kind of thing, which I felt sold the story he was building up to that point quite short. It felt like there were a lot of threads that were abandoned in service of this rug pull of an ending. But up until that point, I did enjoy it. What did you guys think?
I really, really enjoyed it. In fact, this would be my film of the week. As a Blade Runner huge fan, you're probably more discerning of this sort of thing. But I sort of like the fact that it did evoke that Blade Runner world. And there were elements of it, for reasons we won't go into, that really nod to other classics. Like, you know, he's driving a DeLorean at one point, and, you know, Rhona Mitri is his boss. You know, she famously has been in other sort of things that nod to this rug pull, which you're discussing. So I sort of liked all of that and this sort of moody cinematography and the human interaction, even though there isn't human, but it's with robots, of this, the fact that he's built these robots and become this weird family in this beautiful big old house in Japan. I just found the whole thing, the world building that the director can do, as we know from his previous work, really, really satisfactory. And I enjoyed that rug pull. I was like, oh, wait, it's not... Oh, it is. Oh, and now I want to watch it again, knowing what I know at the end. So I loved it. Matt?
I was somewhere in the middle, and I did like it. And similar to what Jordan said, I thought it was one of those films where, oddly, I would say you can sense it was done on a small budget, but you could also tell that it was kind of like a VFX expert behind it. And you felt that they were doing a really good job with a minimal budget. And especially also like the fact that these different iterations of the J are largely practical. And it's got that kind of man in a suit kind of feeling to it, but in a way that I found sort of enjoyable and like a nice kind of throwback and nicely sort of solid. It did feel a bit to me like a sort of a Black Mirror without the humor. And it's not really the sort of film that will sort of really stand on its own as like a sort of great, memorable sci-fi film, but it was sort of enjoyable enough if you treat it as a bit of a sort of throwaway thing that maybe, yeah, again, if it was part of an anthology, or maybe if it was just a little bit shorter, perhaps I would have... Yeah, felt like it would have worked a bit better.
Because it's close to 2 hours, isn't it? For me, it was slightly too much of a slow burn to start with. Like, I felt like it didn't really go in for a good like 40 minutes, which is, you know, a bit too long.
Liked that he's sort of wandering around in the forest, and it's this, the fact that he's this solo lone person. It reminded me of a lot of other films that do this really well. I mean, it reminded me of Moon itself, you know, the man alone building his world and trying to create a life for himself.
It's very reminiscent of Moon as well in the kind of graphic design of it all. Like the technology is set, you know, what, 20-ish years in the future. And it's got that chunky sort of slightly lo-fi feel to everything, which, you know, you can very much tell that this has come from the conceptual designer behind Moon. But I don't have a problem with that because I think it's a really, really great looking film. Probably its strongest point is just the way it looks. Mm-hmm. So if you just want to bathe in visuals, then you're not going to go wrong with this film.
And what about Theo James? I mean, obviously, he's best known probably for the Divergent franchise. I actually thought he was really good in this. I was pleasantly surprised.
I thought he was solid, subdued. Oh. I didn't think like he had a ton of great stuff to do just because he's, you know, acting against robots for the most part. Weirdly, I just thought the best performer in the entire film was J2, which is a kind of boxy robot, which I don't know if that says a lot for J2 or a lot against Theo James, but J2 was a standout performance for me.
And as you say, her arc, I shed a tear for her.
I know.
There's a particular scene in it that's really quite impactful. It's very good what they do with that boxy robot. And I also, you know, enjoyed the fact that these robots were women. He'd built them as women. And obviously the sort of Lear-esque thing that happens with that, you know, he is their king. And then what do the daughters do and how do they fight amongst themselves is quite interesting. And also the questions about whether, you know, you should preserve somebody's soul, for want of a better word, in a box for your own grief and your own amusement through the months after they've passed in order to help you through a process. Is that morally right? Although that bit did remind me a bit of that. Do you remember that Transcendence film with Johnny Depp where he put himself into a computer, which was not good? But yeah, I liked all those sort of questions, and it's something that I think it will stick with me, that one, and I will probably watch it again.
That is a theme that a lot of films have tried to tackle in the past, but most of them seem to get it really wrong. Like there was that Keanu Reeves film from a couple of years back, Replicas, which is basically this plot, but god awful. So this, it feels like we're making progress with this idea of, you know, resurrecting loved ones and the boundaries between AI and human consciousness and all these huge philosophical ideas that, you know, science fiction has been obsessed with for decades. This has all of those at its core, and it does do some interesting things with it. I just felt like there were a few missteps for me. But as you know, as a directorial debut, I did find it hugely impressive, especially given that I can only imagine how minuscule minuscule the budget was he was working with.
Yeah, as a showcase for things to come, I think it's really, really strong. Okay, so that is Archive, which is available on all platforms from Monday. Right, shall we move on from the drama that we've been talking about to the documentaries with this?
Violence is self-defeating. He who lives by the sword will perish by the sword.
You know, when you construct a man as a great man, there's nothing almost more satisfying than also seeing him as the opposite.
When the National Archive puts government documents up on the web, one has to confront them.
Tapes from the hotel rooms, FBI reports, those are pieces of information that we shouldn't have. The FBI was most alarmed about King because of his success.
So this is a documentary about Martin Luther King and his tussles with the FBI. Not something we know much about, Matt. So tell us what this informs us of.
Yeah, so yeah, this wasn't something I was at all particularly aware of beforehand. But as you can kind of tell from the title, it's about obviously Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And it's really about him and, on the other hand, J. Edgar Hoover, who was the director of the FBI for sort of 35 years or so up until his death in 1972. And it looks at what the FBI basically did to try to stop the rise of Martin Luther King, who was such a powerful revolutionary figure. They were clearly very nervous about how far his reach might go and how big his influence might be. This just basically follows the what the FBI did under Hoover's direction to basically try and quell his growth and sort of seed doubt about him through, firstly, kind of reported communist connections that they were trying to pin on him, and also the kind of adultery that we know a bit about, that he's kind of known for his extramarital affairs that he had, and how they tried to use that to, yeah, basically discredit him and put a stop to his following. And this is based on recently sort of released documents from the FBI sort of archive. I personally found it a really interesting film, directed by Sam Pollard and released by Dogworth in this country, who always I find pretty reliable for, they've got very good quality control. So generally when they release documentaries, they're pretty interesting. And it has just some really, really great archive footage of Martin Luther King. Some of it's just so crisp, you know, you just don't know how it was kind of restored or kind of looked after to look so good. And also some interesting stuff with J. Edgar Hoover as well. It is, like I say, it felt very much felt like it was about these two guys to me, and just really, really nicely done. Interesting, gives you a lot to think about. It doesn't really give you much sort of salacious information about Martin Luther King, if that's what you're after. And it feels like, you know, there's perhaps more to be said about him, and it doesn't really dig into the sort of the moral side of that. It doesn't really kind of question him as a leader. It doesn't really call into question his sort of, you know, validity because of those, but it leaves you with a lot to think about. Yeah, just very, very gripping, very interesting, really worthwhile documentary, I'd say.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with everything you said, Matt. I think it's James Comey in the documentary, obviously the former FBI director himself, who says that this is pretty much the darkest chapter in the history of the FBI. And I totally get that. It's really quite shocking, just the levels of harassment and surveillance that they undertook on Martin Luther King Jr. They were tapping his phones. They were listening in on every single conversation he was having. At one point, someone in the agency sends him this horrible letter, basically trying to expose him and telling him to kill himself. It's really genuinely horrific stuff. And just the weird sort of grudge that Hoover had for Martin Luther King, I just found really kind of the stuff of movies. Like, I could see this being like a narrative feature in a few years. Just the fact that, you know, very shortly after Martin Luther King Jr. was announced as the recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, Hoover gives a quote to a newspaper, a national newspaper, saying that he's the most notorious liar in America. This becomes the story, this weird spat between J. Edgar Hoover and Martin Luther King Jr. when, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. has done so much to forward civil rights in America. It's just very bizarre that Hoover took this man's quest so personally and was seemingly single-handedly doing so much to undermine him and everything that he stood for. It's an incredible story. As you say, there's some remarkable archive footage in it. There are sort of talking head voiceovers, but they don't feel intrusive. Like, for me, for the most part, it felt like they added to the story that they were telling. I mean, for the most part, they're not even really people you've heard of. It's kind of confidants of Martin Luther King Jr. or it's academics, and there's James Comey as well. So it doesn't feel like you're getting, you know, intrusive celebrity input in the middle of this quite serious story. that I thought was very illuminating. Again, as with a lot of films this week, actually, it taught me a lot. It was quite illustrative of a period of time as well that I knew a bit about, but didn't know tons about. I'd really recommend it. I mean, the one thing I wasn't so sure about was, you know, all the extra details about King's private life and these extramarital affairs. I'm always just slightly uncomfortable about that stuff because, you know, for me, it doesn't change what he did as an activist, as a political activist. Like, does it really matter that we know he had affairs outside of his marriage? I don't know why this stuff sort of needs dredging up, because the film sort of also points out that there's going to be sort of more documents released in, I think it's in six years in 2027. And they're kind of speculating about what those could reveal, unless it turns out that, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. was a serial killer or something. Like, I don't think it really matters, you know, that sort of between him and his wife. I don't get why we have to sort of dwell on that quite so much. But because it's a part of the story of harassment, it is an important detail to go into.
It sort of sounds like it would be a good companion piece to the documentary we saw a couple of weeks ago on Billie Holiday and her harassment by the FBI and the fact that they wanted to try to shut her down as well as a popular sort of person who was championing civil rights.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. They're very much companion pieces.
Yeah. Because the only thing I would say, just to pick up something that Jordan said as well, actually, I almost felt like with the talking heads or the, you know, not talking heads, but the voiceovers, sorry, they give little names at the bottom of who they are. But for the most part, there's a couple that you kind of know who they are and can work out, but I almost found it a bit distracting to not know who it was who was talking. Then at the end, you basically see them as talking heads briefly at the end with an explanation of who they all are. It wasn't enough to kind of, you know, derail the film for me, obviously, but I just would have minded that being a bit clearer.
Okay, so that is MLK FBI and is available on all platforms from tomorrow. So that is a wide selection of movies. What is your film of the week?
I'm going to go with One Night in Miami. Definitely worth checking out, but it's, you know, a mixed week, but at least a couple in there that are well worth seeking out.
Matt?
I would also say One Night in Miami. So if you watch one thing this week, I would say make it that.
I'd go for Archive. I really, really liked it. So there you go. That would be my pick. Shall we have a reader's question before we depart then? And this does tap into the Archive one, which is, what dystopian future would you have the best chance of surviving? So what movie world are you going to go in and kick ass?
Well, I've got two. I've got my very simple answer, which I'll say Wall-E would be a very easy dystopia to technically survive because all you have to do is like lie there.
And get fat in space.
Eat Cheetos. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And watch TV. That'd be dead easy. I can do that because that's basically what I do now. But my serious answer is The Matrix, because The Matrix is basically just a big video game, and I play video games and I'm quite good at video games. So I think I'd be quite good in the Matrix world.
Mm. And wear sunglasses, obviously.
I look really cool in sunglasses.
In a wraparound shade.
Coat, so.
Yeah, there we go.
Exactly.
Matt?
If we're classing this as a dystopia, I would say Idiocracy, just because I don't think it'd be that different to what we're living through today. So I think I could probably survive in a world full of idiots.
I wouldn't want The Handmaid's Tale. No, thank you. I'd quite like a go at Waterworld. I can't sail and I'm no good at distilling water.
You don't have gills, do you?
I don't have gills. So it's not looking good for me. Maybe I'll be a smoker and I'll just jet ski around smoking cigarettes and like jumping onto atolls and abusing everyone. Maybe that would be my thing. Obviously, you know my Costner love. So if I was in Waterworld, I could maybe, you know, hook up with the Mariner and we could just sail the seven seas together.
I knew that's where that was going. I knew it was going to end up with you and Kev in some kind of aquatic tryst.
Just looking for dry land together and, you know, idyllic. He can grow me tomato plants. I can tell him stories and, you know, he could go fishing. I can just, you know, look after the boat. It's going to be lovely.
Sounds like a utopia to me, not a dystopia.
It always is, wherever there's Kevin Costner. Okay, so on that note, we should also mention that the new issue is out now, drum roll, and it features what on the cover, Matt?
It features Fast and Furious 9, which heads up our massive 2021 preview of like just all the films to be hopefully excited to see this year. God willing, we'll get to see these films this year.
Yeah, we'll see, because as we know in the news that No Time to Die is apparently moving again to the winter.
Yeah, and I spoke to Vin Diesel for the Fast and Furious 9 feature and he was very committed to releasing it in cinemas. So if cinemas aren't open, then don't expect Fast 9 to come out, is what I would say.
It's a wish list. But do buy it. It's in stores now. So go and get it with your weekly shop. Or if you're doing your exercise, have a little run past the paper shop. Okay, so that's it for this week. We'll be back next week. But for now, let's say goodbye. Goodbye, chaps.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. I am sailing home again, across the sea. I am sailing stormy waters.